Hello, and welcome to Distillations, weekly extracts from the past, present, and future of chemistry. I'm Robert Hicks. Each week, we bring you stories on all things chemical, from argon to the afterlife. In this week's show, we're talking about the chemistry of religious experience. We'll learn about zombies and talk to an expert on medical miracles. That's all coming up on today's episode of Distillations. One of the oldest clichés in the history of science is that science and religion are in conflict. For almost a generation now, scholars have been arguing that it's a lot more complex than that. They point to the fact that Isaac Newton considered himself a theologian, and a surprising number of famous botanists were also members of holy orders. Religion has always had a place in science. But in this week's show, we're looking at the role of science in religion, starting with the biggest question of them all. What is a soul? Julia Urtasy offers an answer in today's Element of the Week.
Most of the elements featured on this show can be found neatly arranged in schemes that account for their weight and mass and other characteristics. While this week's element isn't in the periodic table, it once denoted the breath of life. In fact, the name for this substance, pneuma, comes from the Greek word for breath. For Aristotle, pneuma was the fifth element, beyond the standard four of earth, air, fire, and water. It was thought to occur only in living things, and to transmit the soul to future generations. To the ancient Stoic philosophers, pneuma was part material, part insubstantial vapor. It manifested itself in color, activity, and life. Pneuma was also crucial to early chemistry. The Egyptian alchemist Zosimos believed that pneuma was essential for the transmutation of substances. Before a substance could be transformed, it had to be reduced back to its original state. The resulting body would then require the addition of pneuma, the life-giving force, to give it a new form, maybe gold or maybe just something that ranked higher in the order of things. But the idea of pneuma didn't last. By the 17th century, when William Harvey discovered the circulation of blood, the concept had disappeared. Mostly. Today, pneumatology is the Christian study of the Holy Spirit. Others continue to see pneuma as the breath of life, or soul. In 1901, surgeon Duncan MacDougall placed dying tuberculosis patients on scales to register minute changes in weight at the instant of death. He found that people lose about 21 grams at the crucial moment, an amount, he reasoned, that indicated the weight of the departing soul. And that's it for the Element of the Week. I'm Julia Urtasy.
Julia Urtasy is an intern with Chemical Heritage magazine. Over the past 2,000 years, the Roman Catholic Church has recognized at least 3,000 saints. The most difficult stage of canonization is beatification. That's the process of proving that the candidate for sainthood has performed at least two posthumous miracles. The Vatican's Miracle Verification Unit confirms whether miracles have indeed taken place. To find out more about this process, CHF's Audra Wolf spoke with Jackie Duffin, who knows about it firsthand. Duffin is a hematologist and historian of medicine at Queen's University in Ontario.
Good morning, Jackie. Welcome to Distillations.
Thank you for inviting me.
You offered a medical report on a leukemia case that was important in establishing a case for sainthood. Can you tell us about your experience with that?
When I was first asked for my medical opinion on the case, I didn't realize that it was a case for canonization. I thought that perhaps it was a lawsuit, and I was asked to read a set of bone marrows, blind, without knowing who the patient was or what the treatments were, and then give an opinion on the course of the leukemia that the patient had. And I handed in the report, expecting perhaps that the patient was dead and maybe the doctor was being sued. And it turned out that the patient was still alive and that her case was being considered as a miracle, the final miracle in the dossier of the first Canadian saint to be canonized.
Now, you're a historian as well as a physician, and your involvement with this kind of sparked some interest in how this process worked. And I've read that you've looked at the records of over 600 miracles. What are some of the patterns that emerge?
My research in the Vatican archives was sparked by that experience as a hematologist. I wondered what the other miracles were. And now my research is up to 1,400 miracles between the years of 1588 and 1999. And what I have found is that about 96% of these miracles are healings from physical illness. That was something that I didn't know at the outset, and I found it interesting that the ways in which the church endorses evidence of the saints' ability to work wonders or evidence of their proximity to God is in healing.
What constitutes a medical miracle from the Catholic Church's point of view?
The church doesn't have a strict definition of what is a medical miracle. Rather, the miracles emerge from the faithful people who pray to the future saints. They believe that something happened that wasn't expected to happen, and they come forward with their stories to their priests and to the people in their community. And if the church is convinced that it's worth investigation, then a tribunal is set up to interrogate not only the patient, but their entire family, all the people in their sphere, including their priests and the nuns and nurses who might have looked after them, and also the doctors.
How have modern therapeutics and diagnostic tools changed what counts as a miracle?
Modern science was always incorporated. So if it was a 16th century miracle, they were using the latest and greatest ideas that were out and about in the 16th century. The same for the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries. So as soon as a technology or an idea had been invented, it would soon appear in the testimony of these stories. It seems that the Vatican experts are looking for two things. First, they're looking that the patient was treated with the best science available at any given time, and they're looking for the doctors to be willing to say that the patient was going to die anyway. So one of the things they're looking for is medical surprise. They're looking for the doctor to be very surprised at the outcome.
Has your research on miracles and your kind of involvement with this case changed your attitudes about faith and health?
Oh, yes, in many ways. I have always had patients who are believers. I now understand that and accept it more easily. I also understand from my patients and also from this research that healing is about a lot more than what your blood tests show and what your weight is and what the x-rays show. Another thing it has done is loosened up my attitude towards medical science. I see it as a form of belief as well. And in many ways, it is parallel to the kinds of beliefs that inform the people who pray to the saints.
Thanks so much, Jackie.
My pleasure.
Jackie Duffin is Hannah Professor in the History of Medicine at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Her new book, Medical Miracles, Doctors, Saints, and Healing in the Modern World, will be released in October by Oxford University Press. Have comments or questions about something you've heard on our show? Send your thoughts to distillations@chemheritage.org. You're listening to Distillations. I'm Robert Hicks. The zombie is a staple of late-night horror movies. Zombies are usually shown as corpses of the recently deceased, who rise out of their graves to attack living people and eat their brains. But what do these Hollywood night terrors have to do with chemistry or religion? The answer lies with zombie powder. Gigi Naglack has more in this week's Mystery Solved.
Our story begins in Haiti during the United States occupation of that country from 1915 to 1934. Journalist William Seabrook introduced the word zombie into the American lexicon after he toured Haiti and wrote a book about its romantic and exotic attractions, particularly voodoo religion. Voodoo, which is embraced by almost all Haitians, derives from West African spiritualism. It involves ecstatic rituals in which worshipers are possessed by spirits. Some Haitian voodoo practitioners, called bokors, allegedly use zombie powder to raise the dead. Since the 1980s, a number of anthropologists and ethnobotanists have traveled to Haiti to investigate zombies, but that hasn't been easy. Part of the difficulty has been the lack of people recently returned from the dead who want to talk about their experiences. And interviews with bokors and attempts to collect and analyze zombie powder haven't solved the controversy over whether or how it works. The debate centers on the chemical effects of a molecule called tetrodotoxin that's found in some, but not all, zombie powders. Tetrodotoxin comes from the organs of a pufferfish and some other marine life. When given the right amount of the compound, animals can become paralyzed. Their blood pressure drops steeply, and their breathing is nearly suspended. Despite all this, the animal sometimes remains fully conscious. To create a zombie, A Bokor administers just enough powder to simulate death for a short time. Then he rescues the victim from a tomb before the victim suffocates, seemingly raising him from the dead. But the Bokor has to be careful, since an overdose of tetrodotoxin can be deadly. Some Bokors admit to administering zombie powder, and some people claim they've been made into zombies. But the zombie phenomenon remains more myth and conjecture than verifiable fact. Mystery solved? Perhaps not yet. But in the meantime, don't worry about dead people coming to eat your brains. I'm Gigi Naglack.
Gigi Naglack is a curatorial assistant at CHF. And that's it for this week's episode of Distillations. Today's quotation comes from Albert Einstein's 1941 book, Science, Philosophy, and Religion. Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. Distillations is a presentation of the Chemical Heritage Foundation and is made possible by the generous support of the Richard Lounsbery Foundation. Mia Lobel is our senior producer, with help this week from Lissa Rome. Our assistant producer is Victoria Indeviro, and our executive producer is Audra Wolfe. Our theme music is composed and performed by Dave Kaufman. Additional music provided from the PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com. Please tell us what you think about our program and send suggestions for future shows to distillations@chemheritage.org. Until next time, I'm Robert Hicks.